Hello, and what a really rare and wonderful privilege to be in the same place with all of you and to be on the outer end of a very fine stretch of time here in Seattle. You can imagine, any of you who've lived in other places, what an exotic spot in the world this is. Bert made me promise I'd go home and tell everybody it rained and the weather was miserable. But not true. So this has just been a very wonderful space in time, and also staying at the home of Bert Sachs, I feel that I have earned a few points in being able to talk about simplicity. Bert's a wonderful host, and it's been great to be here as his guest as well. And very special thanks to Einoch, to Snow, to Pastor Olive for the use of the church tonight, and to all of you for coming on a beautiful evening to choose to be indoors and to think about some things which are so very, very painful, so very, very hard. I think that my message is fairly simple. It condenses into a belief that where you stand determines what you see. And it's no news to many, maybe all of you here, that it's so important that we try to stand with the people who bear the brunt of warfare as we seek to create a world wherein it's easier to be good, wherein we'll stop this incredible addictiveness we seem to have to using the methods of warfare. And so if by telling you tonight a little bit about what it was like to stand with the Iraqi people in the build-up toward this most recent war and then through the war and in the first 10 days of occupation, I hope that my words might maybe assist all of us in convincing people who all around the United States were against the war before it started, that they were right in the first place, and perhaps building up our own sense of encouragement that even though it may seem that all of your efforts to stop that war before it started might have resulted in the air kind of going out of the balloon because the war happened anyway, that when we calculate that we're 6% of the world's population, that in the remaining 94% of the world, there are millions of people, millions, who joined you and came close to achieving the critical mass that we all want so badly we can just about taste it, that critical mass that would stop a war before it starts. We came so close. And I believe that one of the ways, one way to help prevent a next war could be to fully tell the truth about this war. So allow me to start with some words about what we might call pre-traumatic stress disorder. We coined that kind of with a giggle in Baghdad as we were packing emergency kits for ourselves and buying bottled water and trying to do everything we could to prepare in advance for a war that looked increasingly inevitable. And yet there were some kind of macabre twists to that. We would put inside our crash kits pliers to pull out shrapnel in case one of us were so wounded, and we recognized that we ourselves had access to so much more in terms of emergency medicines than the average Iraqi. But the pre-traumatic stress disorder story that stays with me the most is perhaps the one that most needs to be told. In southern Iraq, in Basra, I've been so privileged to get to know families in a small neighborhood called Jumuria. It's, I think, the poorest neighborhood in Basra. And on one particular street, the families were always at a very high risk of waterborne diseases because they didn't have any pavement, they didn't have any curbs, and the sewage and the muck could slide right into their homes. There wasn't any protection from that. So the good news, when I went there in January of 2002, was that there was a big, huge bulldozer parked out in front of the home of Majid and Karima. Majid, an artist, also someone who worked so hard in an oil company as a person who tried to, as a mechanic, service vehicles, but never could get enough purchasing power in his pockets to really meet his family's needs. And Karima, a delicate woman, a superb mother. She could have taught parenting courses, I think, anywhere in the world. She had raised such beautiful children. Well, the more difficult news was that Karima, like several other women who'd spoken to me in that neighborhood, was experiencing a form of pre-traumatic stress disorder such that every time she heard a loud roar or a huge explosion, it would send her into memories of 1991, and she would immediately collapse with the remembrance of what that war had been like. And so, on a given morning, she did what she would do normally. She put on her hijab, donned her abaya, prepared to go to the market with her bag. And the person operating the bulldozer did what he would do, beginning a day's work. He turned on the machine. The deafening roar reminded Karima of 1991's planes coming in to drop bombs, and she immediately began again to convulse. She fell down in a cold faint, and her head hit the claw of the bulldozer, and she died instantly. And so, to visit their home, I had, in a previous trip, bought oils and paints and brushes so that Majid could continue to create his beautiful art. Now when you walk in that little tiny hovel, a picture of her face radiates forth from the wall. And I found that story emblematic of what so many people were telling me, people who had been strong, incredibly representative of fortitude in my life through these long years of economic sanctions, people saying, "Kathy, I cannot continue. I cannot go on," trembling. Grown men saying that they felt as though they and their families were handcuffed and in front of the world's largest arsenal as a firing squad, and there was nothing they could do, no place they could go, people feeling trapped. Well, then, as we all kind of braced ourselves, just waiting for the exact day, the bombing began. And on the first two nights, quite honestly, we started to wonder, maybe the United States was going to show restraint. Maybe it wouldn't be so bad. Actually, this is how the Army Times described it on a March 21st article that I read after returning. Shock and awe, it wasn't until day three. Pinpoint targeting and care marked the opening days of the war, with coalition aircraft flying 1,600 strike sorties dubbed conditioning work over the first 2 days. But on A Day, Pentagon parlance for day three, air power left its considerable impression on the Iraqi landscape. More than 2,000 sorties, half of them strike sorties involving every kind of aircraft we have, deposited thousands of munitions on key targets, and every single munition was either laser or satellite guided, according to a senior defense official. Well, from the receiving end of that onslaught, I can tell you that the Al-Fanar Hotel, a family hotel, seven stories high, run by a Muslim family who had invited their extended relatives to come and join us, and had also invited a Christian family who lived nearby to their family home to also move into the hotel, and where several of the hotel workers' spouses and children had joined us, we were quite a tightly linked community. My friend Wade Hudson, who lives in San Francisco and was with us throughout the bombardment, said that he would liken it to being akin to experiencing 11 San Francisco earthquakes, one after another, on a given day. And then the next day, it started all over again. The building wavered back and forth, the floors trembled, the windows shuddered, and there were gut-wrenching explosions. But some things I noticed were that every time there was an explosion, adults would check to see where their children, and if the children were there, there was an instant poker face. No one wanted to express more alarm than the kids might already be feeling. And I also was very touched at some points to see that there would be a big explosion and one woman would make the sign of the cross, and sitting across from her, a man might pull out his prayer mat and unfurl it and begin to pray. So there we were in the hotel with toddlers and teenagers. The teenagers, started to play almost obsessively, I thought, a board game called Risk, a game of military domination. It's, life has its ironies. And I remember one night, my friend Cynthia Banas, age 79, who stayed downstairs in the bomb shelter, which was just like, you know, an average basement, but it was a little more insulated from the noise that would wake us up in the middle of the night on the upper levels. Cynthia wanted the kids to settle down and go to bed. The elderly people and the kids stayed downstairs. And she said to the ones playing Risk, "You know, you could always finish the game tomorrow." And little Dima, age 8, looked at Cynthia and said, "But Madame Cynthia, we might not be here tomorrow." And I was, I suppose, most privileged to play with the two youngest, Milada and Zainab. Milada, at age 3, had an emerging personality, such a delicate frame, beaming eyes. And her sister, Zainab, age 1 1/2, just beginning to walk and would open out her arms and just charm all of us so much. And you know how kids, the first time they get to know you might be a bit standoffish, but if you're there the next day, suddenly it's the honeymoon is on. So she, these kids would both let us help their parents, rock them to sleep at night and carry them up and down hallways. And so I started to notice that morning, noon, and night, they were grinding their teeth incessantly. And little Milada had a game that she always wanted to play, it seemed, and the game involved shouting out the Arabic word for airplane. Tayara, tayara! And then she would wave her arm around in an arc shouting, "Tayara!" and bring her fist to punch herself so that she could imagine what it would be like if one of these gut-wrenching explosions hit her. And when the electricity went out completely in the Alphonar Hotel, and as the sun would go down, sometimes their mom would be caught in the staircase without any lights and with a child in each arm, I'd come running with a flashlight to help out as she was groping her way. And little Milada always wanted the flashlight. And I'd try to play shadow shows or Tinkerbell, but she wanted to use the flashlight to pretend it was a gun. And first she'd point it at her mother, "At-tat-tat!" And then she'd point it at me, "At-tat-tat!" Imitating what I think she was trying to cope with, because she knew that one of these explosions could kill her mother or her new big friend. And I suppose I had to cope with an obsession of my own, because it came over me that I'd hear these explosions and I'd start to imagine the young conscripts underneath. I know a lot of teenagers, because over the years the Shoeshine Boys had grown up, and some of the young hotel workers were in the army as conscripts, and they were all unwilling conscripts. I knew they didn't want to be there. I knew the story of young Saif, who had been conscripted by the Ba'ath Party, told he and his friends that they must show up, and you wondered, how are they all? And were they underneath one of those big thuds and blasts? And there wasn't any way to find out. There were no phones. There wasn't any electricity. The communication was down. And so I had to stop myself from thinking about what could happen to those kids. But again, when I came back to the United States, I read an Army Times description. And it said on a particular day that 70% of an Iraqi troop unit had been degraded. And as an English teacher, I thought, oh, like they got a C minus on the... I later read a New York Review of Books article in which the author was very indignant about that phraseology. He said, no, it was wrong to say that the troop unit was degraded. It would have been better to say that 70% of the troop unit was pureed. And do you know, on that day 3, on a day of the bombing, the cost in terms of dollars and cents was $1 billion. And it never let up, day 4, day 5, day 6. It was always the same, morning, noon, night, no matter where you went. We even held a birthday party out on the riverfront in full view and hearing earshot of the terrible bombing, because there wasn't any place safer, and we just declared that we'd have normalcy in defiance of war. And it was a wonderful birthday party with party favors and white plastic chairs and kids playing duck, duck, goose. And those who'd been so pent up inside, these teenage girls and boys being able to run and play and just get it out of their systems a bit. But I watched myself on a videotape when I came back to the U.S. at the birthday party, and I was kind of appalled because there's this huge explosion and I don't even stop my sentence. And I looked, the kids were still just running around playing, but then the camera, with another explosion, focused on the mother of the birthday girl. Her name is Karima. And Karima first had a look of alarm because she needed to know where was Mahmoud, the youngest, at age 6. And then when she realized he was okay, there was a look of relief. And then her face changes to register the kind of an expression that some of you may have felt or have seen when somebody else's children are behaving very, very badly. And Karima gives that expression of just frustrated disgust at what the big children, the U.S. Army, are doing. When the bombing stopped, I think a lot of people in Iraq wanted to exhale. Yes, they wanted release from the regime of Saddam Hussein. It had been a horrible and a cruel and a ruthless regime. It was a very efficient police state. I would argue that as the ruthless and efficient police state in Iran had been overthrown from within the country, and likewise in Romania, the Romanians overthrew Ceausescu, I think eventually the Iraqis that Jerry and Bert and Larry Kirshner and I and others, so many from Seattle, had come to know, I think they could have overthrown Saddam Hussein's regime from within. They would have needed the middle class strengthened. Sanctions wrecked the middle class. They would have needed education. Sanctions caused a terrible decline in education. They would have needed to have social services functioning. The sanctions thwarted social services. And oh, how they would have needed communication. Sanctions left them so beleaguered. So that's an argument that, in a sense, maybe begins to recede in terms of relevancy. But I don't think any of us should say that the Iraqis can be jubilant and thankful, because even though there weren't weapons of mass destruction, even though there weren't connections made with Al-Qaeda, we got rid of Saddam Hussein, and only war could do that. I don't believe that's true. When the occupation rolled in then, Iraqis who wanted to exhale found that there wasn't even a chance for that. Because as one doctor in Saddam City put it, he said, it's as though you've been under an operation and the anesthetic is starting to wear off. You feel pain and you feel fear. You sense that you're waking up from a nightmare but descending into another one. And when people realized that armored personnel carriers had been dispatched to protect the Ministry of Oil Building, where my friend Sattar said that was the place that housed the maps and the information so that the oil wealth would be preserved, but nobody seemed to know even where to find the clinics and the hospitals and the storage places where food and extra meds were stored, and those were looted when the hospitals turned into war zones, when the ministries were attacked. It was as though the ground had gone out from under people, and the only way I could explain it in some ways was to say that I usually understand Iraqis as people with flashing, gleaming, dark eyes. But as I listened to people I knew well stare straight ahead of themselves and try to describe what they were feeling and what they were thinking, it was as though their eyes had turned a different color, a somber hue, an almost deer-skinned color. And I remember so clearly the mother of the two little girls I told you about sitting in front of the big plate glass window of the Al-Fanar Hotel and staring out as the occupation seemed to take shape larger and larger, more armored personnel carriers and Humvees and tanks and jeeps arriving. And tears were streaming down her face, and she murmured to me, never did I think that this could happen to my country. And I feel very sad. And I think that this sadness, it will never go away. I wanted to give her some time alone. I wanted to take the children away for a bit. So I thought, well, I'll take the children outside. God knows we all need some fresh air. And then I realized, no, I can't do that. There's concertina wire being unrolled outside. We're under occupation. And then I thought, well, I can take one in each arm and hold on to them and go outside. But I know I'm so extroverted, I would start to talk to the soldiers, because we'd already been interacting with these soldiers, and they were kids. They were forthright. decent guys. They'd want to see these children and behold them like the beautiful flowers that they were. But I couldn't do that. They were Zainab's children, and she was weeping over this occupation. And then I cast my glance to the TV that had been set up. Well, that was showing footage of corpses strewn on the streets of Baghdad. That wouldn't work. I ended up taking the children down to the bomb shelter. And there is a grave symbol there. Meeting the soldiers was a very important moment for us in the Iraq peace team. It was a moment of huge uncertainty. We just didn't know. Would there be a bloodbath right outside the hotel? We knew that there were weapons stashed two doors down, and in the hotel immediately behind us, there were looters 10 minutes away at the Jumeirah Bridge. Was it possible that even though they said the government had crumbled, that some loyalists to the government might not know that and might pull out the weapons? So when the soldiers arrived, it was a very tense moment for them and for us. And earlier, the previous day, the tank round had been fired, even on the hotel where all the journalists were living. So it was very confusing. We nevertheless decided that we had a responsibility to unfurl the banners that we had held kind of in waiting for a long time. Earlier, we'd gone down to the Kuwait-Iraq border and fasted there for 3 days and unfurled banners that said, "Courage for peace, not for war," hoping somehow this message could go across that border to the soldiers. But by the time the bombing had ended, we'd made a new banner, and it said, and it told the truth, "War equals terror." An operation shock and awe, and I blush to say it in the church. Operation shock and awe did undertake the stated and avowed aims of terrorists anywhere. And people in Iraq, by that time, by the end of the war, were terrified almost to death. So we held up our sign, "War equals terror," and "Courage for peace, not for war." And the hotel owner, a very dear man, said, "Please, you are like family, like friends to us, you know this, but you take your banners, you go upstairs." Because if the tank was going to fire, I guess he thought maybe up one floor. This we did, and we unfurled our banners, and we started to notice the faces, because coming out from the hatches of the tanks and the armored personnel carriers were young men. Actually, it looked like an array of Gerber baby jars to me. They seemed excruciatingly young. And so one of them finally called out, "Well, who are you?" And we called back, "We're a peace team." Another one, I noticed, very deliberately pulled out an Army issue novel and sat on his hatch and just started to read it. And then another one called up and said, "Where are you from?" And we called out cities, Boston, New York, Chicago. "Are you a Red Sox fan?" Well, that was an icebreaker. And I noticed the wall of water that was in our hotel room, and they looked pretty thirsty and tired, and I said so to Cynthia, and Cynthia said, "Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Of course we should bring them some water." And so she had a six-pack of bottled water under each arm, and with her fuchsia pink hat, left over by the Code Pink women, and her summer outfit, she went down to distribute water. And I really wanted to find out what the kid was reading. I went behind her with some dates, intent on connecting with him. The young boy was reading Heart of Darkness. He said, "It's my 13th time reading it." And in our conversations with those young men, one of them said, "We wasn't sure. Was they civilians or was they military? Because we saw fatigues on the ground. So we shot everybody. But I hope it never registers here." And immediately what registered for me was knowing that one of my young friends, Saif, had told me that the battle had gone so badly that a commander had said to the young kids, "If anybody wants to go, just leave." And so he and his two friends had hurried on out of there, and as soon as they could shed their fatigues and change into civilian clothing, they made an exchange at some farmhouse and went racing onward to get back home to their mothers, to their neighborhoods. So sure, there were fatigues on the ground. Another soldier, the commanding officer, said, "Don't blame these young men for what happened. In the heat of battle, I made hasty decisions, and it's I who will have sleepless nights." Another one said, "I never wanted to use this gun. I joined the military to get me some self-respect in life, but I sure didn't want to use it, and it hurt my heart when I saw a car come up to a checkpoint, and one of these other Marines here, he got scared. He thought maybe it was a car bomb, so he used his gun and he shot, and that left an orphan in the back seat of that car. And he didn't have to do that. He could have shot the tires. Another came up to us, put his hands out to Kathy Breen and said, "Will you pray with me?" Another came up and asked me, "Would you just sit down and tell me your side of the story?" So I hope that in the aftermath of war, amongst the many ways that we find to reach out and practice the works of mercy and not the works of war, we'll find ways to give a hand of friendship that is the healing hand, not a patronizing hand, but recognizing we all of us need to be healed to these returning soldiers. As I look over this audience, I know that many of us here tonight can go back in memory quite far, some to the shadow of the mushroom cloud in World War II, some going back as far as Korea, Vietnam, El Salvador, Guatemala, Panama, Grenada, the 1991 Gulf War, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq again, perhaps the next war. And we know we've got a litany of hot war after hot war that must become a challenge to all of us, because there is the underlying subtext in our culture, a subtext of a low-intensity warfare of Western culture against the biodiversity of Mother Earth. How we loved these children up here. How lovable they are. How much they need us to change our culture. There's the underlying subtext of the war of U.S. culture against weaker countries whose resources we want to exploit and control. And that's a war of culture. We have to change our culture. Can we do it? I just came from a war-torn area. Let me bring to you some words of hope. My friend Rod, an architect, an engineer, in the worst pitch time of attack, when there was no electricity, Rod would go up to the rooftop where he could practice his avocation as an astronomer. And he'd pull out a telescope and he'd examine the stars in a way that he never could before. And when he caught me on a kind of down moment, he said to me, "Kathy, you must continue to enjoy the universe." Hisham al-Sharaf, Majid al-Ghazali, two of the finest men you could imagine, came to me after the war with a tape in their hand, and it was all that was left of a school they had nurtured and honed like they were midwives, the Baghdad School of Folk Music and Ballet. The school's been ransacked, their possibilities to be the director and the main pianist for the Baghdad Symphony Orchestra seemed lessened beyond repair. But they gave me a tape that they wanted me to listen to, a very special one, because it's a song that, it's a long story, but I had had a chance to help teach this song to their students some years back. And it's a song that was written after World War I by people who hoped there would never be a World War II. And part of its significance is that it was a song chosen by 150 of the families who, after 9/11, planned memorial services for their loved ones. And when I'd seen a child's drawing of the jumbo jet plowing into the World Trade Center at their school, I had quite honestly asked the child who drew the picture, "Could you help me understand what was on your mind when you drew that?" And this child, 11-year-old Al-Hussein, puffed up, proud like a peacock that the foreigner cared about his picture, instructed me. He said, "Allah wanted this to happen to people in America, so people in America understand what happens to people in other countries when America hits them." His teacher had walked up just then, and he caught her eye and said, "And we love the people in America, and we want to be their friend." Well, goodbye heart. So I told young Al-Hussein and his friends about the fact that I'd been in New York on September 11th, about the idea that many people who lost loved ones felt our grief is not a cry for war, and that they had sung this particular song. So the kids said to me, "And yes, madame, why you not teach us this song?" Well, madame was in trouble because of her Arabic and because of the voice itself. But Hisham and Majid didn't have any concept of "I can't." So I found within 2 days that they had transliterated the song, taught it to the kids, gotten a violinist in on it, and with piano and violin accompaniment, these kids were singing this song to me. Before I left Baghdad on April 19th, Hisham and Majid came over one more time to visit. They wanted to tell me they'd go ahead with their spring concert. They wanted me to know that they would sing this song. And so it gives me a chance to again bring it to an audience here. Ilahi laka neshidi neshidu salam li biladi hum wa biladi adawatani akhladi fi fuadi una akhlamin wa mukatasati lakin kolobon pukra hi biladi pukra tambudubi akhlamin bisutkin mitli ya ilahi asma neshidi neshidu salam Bibinadihim Wabibadi. This is my song, O God of all the nations, a song of peace for lands afar and wide. This is my home, the country where my heart is. Here are my dreams, my hopes, my holy shrine. But other hearts in other lands are beating with hopes and dreams as deep and true as mine. Oh, hear my song, O God of all the nations, a song of peace for their land and for mine. So we sing, believing we are all part of one another, and therein I think we can reach deep for the patriotism that is ours. Thomas Paine put it so well, our country is the world, our religion is to do good.